Welcome to the Baptist Joint Committee for Religious Liberty podcast. I'm Alana Ostrin, the Associate Director of Communications. In this episode, you'll hear BJC General Counsel Holly Holman discuss the foundations of religious liberty. It was one of her two presentations for the 2017 Walter B. and K.W. Sherden Lectures on Religious Liberty and Separation of Church and State. We're sharing this in honor of Constitution Day, which is being observed on September 18th this year. Constitution Day celebrates a seminal day for the United States. On September 17th, 1787, the final draft of the Constitution was signed by 39 delegates. The document was then sent to the states for ratification and went into effect less than a year later on June 21st, 1788. The First Amendment and the Bill of Rights were later ratified in 1791. The constitutional protections for religious liberty, particularly the First Amendment in Article 6, have inspired and informed BJC's work over 80 years of existence. The BJC defends the first freedom of the First Amendment by protecting both the free exercise of religion and defending against its establishment by government. In this podcast, Holly Holman explains how the U.S. Constitution protects religious liberty and what that means for our mission of defending religious freedom for all people. Be sure to follow the BJC on Twitter, at BJC on the Hill, and Facebook to see how else we're marking Constitution Day. Now, here's Holly Holman giving her presentation at Campbell University in North Carolina.
It is the first time I've been here, but it feels very familiar because, like you, I started my education at a Baptist university, and I had a few semesters of a mandatory-ish kind of class like this, where I was exposed to a lot of different speakers, and I remember some of them, but not all of them. And I don't think that at the time I could have imagined that I would end up here on the other side of the auditorium. But you really never know where your education is going to take you. So through your education and perhaps some odd jobs, maybe some internships, maybe on to grad school, you will find yourself in unpredictable places. My advice is that you take the opportunities you see, look for new opportunities, and you will be pleasantly surprised at what comes your way and where you end up. Maybe some of you grew up as Christians in a majority Christian area, maybe in the South, as I did. Maybe you take religious freedom for granted. I know that it wasn't until college that I realized there were so many different kinds of just Baptists, much less all the different Christian denominations and other religions that had such different beliefs that were all important to them. Or maybe you've had some experiences that make you a little bit uneasy about religious freedom or the state of things. Maybe you have big questions. There are definitely a lot of anxieties about new developments in the law. There are changes in culture and apprehension about how we're connected to the world beyond our geographic boundaries. Just look at the headlines. Changes in the law to protect marriage equality for same-sex couples. Requirements that employer health insurance policies cover the cost of contraceptives that some people object to. Religious extremism abroad and fearful reactions at home. And a very changing religious landscape in America, including a growing proportion of Americans that do not identify with any specific religion at all. All of these things influence our conversations and the public's understanding about religious liberty. These headlines indicate some big changes and some real challenges. The issues aren't easy, and you should not be fooled by people who play on your fears and present easy answers to complex problems. There are no shortcuts to understanding these complex issues, and there aren't quick fixes to the conflicts that arise from them. And while these challenges are taking a toll on our country's shared vision for religious liberty, we don't need to be paralyzed by them. Instead, there's a real need for smart students like you, I see you, to understand how we got here, to engage in deliberate debate with people from different perspectives, and to affirm the core principles of religious liberty, to keep our differences from dividing us too deeply. To protect religious liberty, we need to understand what it is. We have to counter some misinformation. We need to know how we protect it, understand how we protect it, and three, appreciate why it's important and how we've benefited from it. We need to recognize the importance of the separation of church and state that we have in America as a means for ensuring religious liberty for all, and reclaim the historical role of Baptist. Okay, so that's kind of a lot to do, right? And I'm only here for 25 minutes. But fortunately, I know that you've chosen a university that's committed to helping students develop intellectually and spiritually. You're being educated and prepared to engage in the world with an appreciation of your religious heritage and a desire to apply what you learn outside the classroom in daily life. I know that, in fact, your president, Brad Creed, who's a former BJC visiting scholar with expertise in this fundamental value of our Baptist and American heritage. So I know that at Campbell, you're poised to build a strong foundation for future engagement on these issues. So where do we begin? Let's start with the definition. What is religious liberty? Religious liberty, or freedom of conscience, freedom of religion, is the right to believe and exercise or act upon religious conscience without unnecessary interference by the government. The right to believe, sometimes referred to as freedom of conscience, means that you can make up your own mind about ultimate things. Your place in the universe, your relationship to God or other supreme being, and your relationship to each other. We are very lucky in this country that we don't fight too much about the right to believe, but we shouldn't take that for granted. Prior to the founding era, religious tests and oath requirements were typical for political positions. And in many parts of the world, even today, there's a link between your religion, your religious status, and your rights in the community, your legal rights. But Article 6 of the U.S. Constitution says there shall be no religious test ever required as a qualification to any office or public trust under the United States. That made it clear that our rights of citizenship in America are separate from and not dependent upon any religious affiliation. This was a significant improvement in the development of legal thought, democracy, and religious freedom, because most of the colonies had some type of religious test for public office. But the founders of the new nation said, no more. Okay, well, the right to believe, of course, is only part of the protection needed to have freedom of religion. As one of the early Supreme Court cases dealing with the freedom of religion put it, the exercise of religion embraces two concepts, freedom to believe and freedom to act. The first is absolute, but in the nature of things, the second cannot. That makes sense, right? The law protects our right to believe in God or not, and to act on it, and it protects our rights to act or exercise our religious beliefs or not. At times, however, there are going to be conflicts between claims of religious freedom and other duties under the law. The extent of our right to exercise our faith depends on the context and the effect of that context on other people. There are some tough cases where courts must resolve those conflicts, or sometimes new laws might be needed. And that's where most of the BJC's work is on a day-to-day basis, like you saw in the video. But there's also a core of religious liberty that is easily understood and widely enjoyed, but often taken for granted by the majority. And it needs tending to, too. The rights that we enjoy that we need to protect are not just for ourselves, but for everyone. And in fact, it's a key expectation of religious liberty that the rights of all denominations and all religions are to be treated equally under the law. Some expressions of religious exercise and religion are common to many faiths. We pray, worship, follow dietary or grooming standards maybe, disseminate religious messages, preaching, teaching, writing. We gather in groups for religious assemblies, and we form organizations to serve others. We proselytize, try to persuade, and we direct our children in our faith. You'll note, these are all voluntary religious practices. Just as religious liberty involves the freedom to practice religion, it also protects the right not to pray, worship, or participate in religious activities. That's important. If you can't say no, then your yes is meaningless. But given the confusion that we sometimes hear about religious liberty, let me say also what it is not. Religious liberty does not mean that the law must reflect all of your religious values, even if your religion is the majority faith. It does not mean that the government can perform your religious duties for you, or that you can use the coercive power of the government to make others conform to your religious belief. So how does it work? How is religious liberty protected in the United States? I mentioned Article 6, that no religious test for office provision, but that's not the only protection. The U.S. Constitution, specifically the first 16 words of the First Amendment, is the more typical place to start. It protects the freedom of religion in a very unique way, and it's allowed people in this country to live with vastly different beliefs to live peaceably together. It says, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. The First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution is an amendment that was demanded for the Constitution's ratification by Baptists and others. It says that the federal government protects religious liberty in these two ways, with these two clauses. This design for the relationship between the federal government and religion also applies to state and local governments, as well as school districts, to ensure that government at any level does not infringe on religious liberty. So what does this mean? Well, the prohibition on the establishment of religion keeps government from advancing or privileging religion. The government does not direct its citizens in religious matters. Your public school teacher does not write and lead classes in prayer. The government doesn't sponsor religious exercises, and it doesn't pick favorites among religions for special legal status. On the free exercise side, second part, it keeps the government from unnecessarily interfering with religious practice. The government protects the rights of individuals, that's the rights to pray, worship, and gather, and at times even allows exemptions from general laws that would otherwise harm religion and burden religion specifically. Together, the idea is that the First Amendment and other laws designed to protect religious freedom keep the government neutral toward religion, neither helping it nor hurting religion, but allowing people to practice or not practice according to their conscience and their traditions. There are many ways that we at the Baptist Joint Committee advocate for this American tradition of religious liberty to ensure that the rights of free exercise are strong and that the government does not try to do the work for us and advance religion. That's what drives our advocacy efforts. Imagine for a minute a prisoner, someone whose life and liberty are severely restricted and thus needs the help of the government to have any semblance of religious freedom. Think about how the government might protect that fundamental right of religious freedom within the confines of a prison and the need for safety there. What if the prison had grooming rules, for example, maybe short hair, no beards, to protect safety? You don't want to hide, you don't want prisoners hiding contraband, drugs, or weapons in their hair. But what if a prisoner's Muslim faith required that he wear a beard? Can this religious freedom be accommodated? The Baptist Joint Committee says yes to accommodation, to make that effort. Imagine a high school student in a public high school who wants to start a Christian student club that meets during non-instructional time. The school has other clubs that meet on campus that aren't related to the school's academic program, but some parents and a couple of administrators worry about allowing such a club because it might appear to promote a specific religion that harms other people's status in the school. Can the school keep the club from meeting, or should it give the club equal access to school facilities on the same basis as others? The Baptist Joint Committee says yes to equal access. On the other hand, what about a public school event that regularly opens with the Pledge of Allegiance and then is followed by a Christian prayer? Should a public school, government-sponsored entity, play the role of church or minister or parent in leading students in a religious exercise at a government-sponsored event? The Baptist Joint Committee says no. Imagine a high-end, super cool retail clothing chain at the mall seeking sales clerks. Think about an applicant who has all the skills necessary to do the work there, but who wears a headscarf as a symbol of her faith. The employer denies her application because the headscarf does not fit with the retailer's look policy that the chain's trying to promote. Should the employer be able to categorically deny such an applicant? The Baptist Joint Committee says no. These are the kinds of issues that arise and require thoughtful attention to protect religious freedom by maintaining the balance that the First Amendment and other laws provide. These are real cases and controversies where we're challenged to live up to the principles that we've inherited and that have served us so well. In each case, we seek to avoid religious discrimination, to protect against government-sponsored religion, and to ensure that individuals can exercise their religion according to their beliefs. The American tradition teaches us that we need both causes, both parts, to protect religious liberty for all. We have to affirm these principles if we want to maintain our freedom for the future. Today, we know that that means looking out for minority faiths, many of them who struggle to enjoy the same religious freedom that we take for granted, and look out for the rights of non-believers, and be aware of government, the dangers of government taking on the role of religion and crowding out authentic religious voices in all their diversity. It means being responsible and faithful Christians, because we as individuals and members of religious communities are responsible for exercising religion. And our freedom to do so is best served when the government does not interfere and we don't ask government to do what God has asked each of us to do. It's an arrangement that is often referred to as the separation of church and state. Okay, so that phrase is not in the Constitution. Have some of you heard that? So maybe you've heard that, and I imagine some of you have heard that said as if it means that the government can or should promote the majority faith, should promote Christianity. But that's not at all consistent with the First Amendment and our legal tradition, nor is that a good idea for spreading the truth and love of Christianity. Separation of church and state is simply a shorthand way of talking about the protections in the First Amendment, and it's shorthand for a deeper truth. Religious liberty is best protected when the institutions of church and state remain separate and neither tries to perform or interfere with the essential mission or work of the other. How are those institutions of religion and government different? Well, think about it. They have different primary responsibilities and concerns. The constituencies are different. You have, in the state, constituencies are the citizens, all paying taxes, all having the same legal rights, versus in a house of worship, the constituencies are the congregants, voluntary participants. The funding sources are different, right? We have compulsory taxation for our citizenship and for our laws, but churches and other houses of worship are supported by the voluntary tithes and offerings. So we know that these entities are different, they serve different purposes, but can work together. And the variety of religious expressions, even in this community, demonstrate these differences. We worship differently, but we're all bound together by laws, by the same laws, and we expect to be treated the same as citizens. To maintain our religious freedom, we need to respect this, separation, and recognize the uniqueness of religion and the uniqueness of religious institutions. At the BJC, we embrace this separation because it's important to protect religious liberty. We don't want government to unduly restrict religion, and we don't want government to try to promote religion. After all, whose religion should it promote? And where does that leave those who are not in the chosen religion? When government tries to aid religion, financially or otherwise, it not only runs the risk of discriminating among faiths, but it also tends to regulate it and often waters down the message, robbing religion of its vitality and independence. That certainly does nothing for the cause of Christianity or any other religion that the government would promote. Of course, separation does not mean hostility to faith. Our whole mission comes out of our faith. We bring our faith to bear on everything we do, and we want to do so freely, not because the government coerces us to do that. Well, at the outset, I said that you are part of this legacy of religious freedom. You've chosen a historically Baptist university to pursue your college education, and I'm sure that you're learning some things here that are distinct about this tradition. But much of what I've said this morning could have been brought to you by someone from a different religious perspective. But I think it's important that you heard it here. Why? It's because Baptists have been known for their contributions to religious liberty. Maybe not every day, maybe not in every community, but historically Baptists have been known for that. Baptists and people from many other traditions believe that we are inherently free, created in God's image, to choose whether to worship God and follow Christ without efforts by the government to advance or restrain religion. This historic commitment to religious liberty for all people can be traced back to the 17th century England and in colonial America, where Baptist leaders called for complete religious freedom. Baptists declared that the government was powerless to control conscience and was incompetent to dictate spiritual matters. You see, at the time, Baptists, not some other religious minority, were the despised, persecuted minority at the time. But through their efforts and those of other minorities, we achieved the legal arrangement that I've been describing today and that has served our country so well and allowed religion to thrive. We have the right to worship freely according to our conscience and tradition, but we aren't coerced into worship by efforts of the state. Religion flourishes on its own. We aren't taxed to pay for state churches or ministers. We enjoy equal rights of citizenship without regard to religion. How did we get there? Just listen to the words of some of our Baptist forebears. Colonial Baptist Isaac Bacus, fighting against the government-established church in Massachusetts, wasn't Baptist, others. He was fighting against them. He says, "Now, who can hear that Christ declare that the kingdom is not of this world, and yet believe that this blending of church and state together can be pleasing to him?" Listen to Baptist John Leland preaching in 18th century Virginia, who said, "Let every man speak freely without fear, maintain the principles he believes, worship according to his own faith, either one God, three gods, no God, or 20 gods, and let the government protect him in doing so." These are bold Christian voices, confident in their faith, demanding separation and religious liberty, not just for themselves, but for others as well. They knew, as we know today, that standing up for religious liberty for others does not mean that you agree with all expressions of religion you see. Diversity of religious expression has always been a hallmark of our country. We can't expect to agree on all matters of faith. That's okay. It's not a specific religious tradition that holds us together as Americans, or even holds perhaps this college community together, or that keeps us living peaceably with our differences. Instead, what has held us together and can help us through the challenges today is our shared tradition of religious liberty for all. I imagine that all of you will encounter these ideas at a deeper level sometime in the future, whether it's through future studies in history or in law or in religion, or through participation in your religious community as members of a congregation or other participants in a house of worship or as leaders in those communities, or perhaps in your civic roles, maybe as political organizers or public office holders. Or maybe just as you try to be good neighbors and try to love your neighbor as yourself. So now, as you go from here, I want you to remember the promise of religious liberty for all that Baptists fought for, that are reflected in the heritage of this university, that our Constitution and other laws have protected, and find ways in your life to affirm and protect and live out this promise of religious liberty so that we can secure it for the future and for each other. Go in peace.
That was Holly Holman delivering one of the Walter B. and K.W. Sheridan lectures on religious liberty and separation of church and state in 2017. Be sure to check us out on Twitter and Facebook to celebrate Constitution Day on September 18th this year. For more podcasts, go to bjconline.org/podcasts. You can also learn more about the Sheridan Lectures on our website at bjconline.org/Sheridan Lectures.